Happy Sunday. This is Swan.
This is Chris.
And you're listening to Ink and Worm on Radio Free Brooklyn. Chris doesn't know to say it with me because Nasa and I do that, but he wouldn't know that. We could try again. You're listening to Ink and Worm on Radio Free Brooklyn, broadcasting out of the basement of a new record shop. If you haven't been there, check it out. They have huge selection, very friendly staff, and records are in.
They
sound better, too. The vibrations are higher. So, Chris is a filmmaker, photographer, and aspiring public media guru who also likes running. And this morning we took the GoPro out on our dog for the first time. So he's making a short about that. You can look for it on the interwebs.
It's going to be pretty great.
A world in a world from the view of Drishti. And I'm going to just dive right into our topic to start, which is you sent me a paper a few months ago that you wrote in 2012 that talked about animal representation in children's books. Do you remember that paper that you sent me?
I do, actually. I was still in undergrad at the time, and I was taking a class about youth literature. And there was a paper prompt that was sort of like basically just write about like children's books, like young children's books. And the topic could be anything. And so, you know, I've always been very interested in environmental concerns, especially dealing with animals. So I was kind of curious to see, well, like, are there certain ways that animals are represented or not represented in, children's books that can potentially affect how, you know, how these kids view animals.
And what did your research unfurl?
Trying to remember.
So the context of the paper is explained. The content is maybe a little fuzzy.
Yeah.
So you introduce it as proper treatment of animals, but also as a crossover to confronting issues that children, towards like respect or, you know, accepting people who are different or, things that could be addressed in children's books, but maybe weren't,
through
the medium of animals.
I mean, one I do remember was there was a couple years back at an American zoo, there was a kind of interesting story in which two male penguins bonded and sort of formed this this relationship. And it got, at the time, it got a lot of media attention just because it was seen as like a homosexual relationship.
Mm-hmm.
And while there are like certainly a fair number of instances of homosexual activity in certain species, it hasn't been widely seen, and definitely hadn't been seen in penguins before, so it was kind of novel, especially it being at a zoo and whatnot.
Sure.
So there is an author who wrote a children's book about these pair of penguins. And I thought that was really great because, you know, kids love animals. Like, I feel like that's...
Yeah, that's usually a given.
Yeah. and so I thought this book was such a great way to sort of introduce this idea that, you know, maybe not all relationships are heterosexual.
Right. I mean, I feel like that's something that's actually been pushed a lot lately in terms of sexual orientation, of just like animals this, animals that, in terms of like there's no one way of coupling or one scale, you know, like polyamory in animals versus monogamy, and then trying to cross over into like human relationships.
Yeah, I mean, there's animals display a pretty wide range of sexual and or, I mean, I don't want to necessarily say romantic because that could be a slightly anthropomorphizing, but sexual and we'll just say romantic for lack of a better term.
Just pairing, sexual, yeah, like pairing, bonding yeah, relationships.
Yeah, any number of pairing and bonding relationships. But yeah, I thought like this book, because it focused on animals and kids love animals, just a really great way to introduce a concept that might be hard to introduce otherwise. Right. And, you know, if you introduce concepts like that at such an early age, then it becomes much easier when you're older to accept those ideas. So in this case, if you're introduced early as a kid that that different kinds of relationships are normal and like there's nothing, they're not portrayed as an other or as a wrong or whatnot, then like when you're older, then you'll feel much more comfortable with them.
Right. And another topic you mentioned was just like addressing racism in children's books through animals. Do you recall?
Ooh, if you give me the name of the book, I might.
Oh, I don't know the name.
or who was portrayed. I could probably, my memory can probably dig it up.
I think it was in the introduction. You just said, namely, books are for children should expose them to allegedly adult topics such as racism, sexuality, and death. So we've talked about sexuality briefly.
racism, I feel like, is a great one to address with different animals because there's a simple setup in the fact that, like, there are all these different species of animals and they're all very different. And, you know, that's like one of the first things you learn, I feel like, as a kid, that you're like...
Yeah, you have different preferences because there is such a variety.
Right, yeah. So, you know, I like snakes more, you like birds more, or whatnot. And so children's books can address that as far as, you know, showing that, okay, well, there's this wide diversity of animals, but they're all... I mean, if you want to do it right, in my opinion, you can portray them as being all equally great and not no animal necessarily being lesser than others, and just like instilling that message that like diversity is wonderful and beautiful and like everyone can bring something to the table. So, you know, maybe a snake looks
celebrating all shapes and sizes.
Yeah. So like maybe a snake looks scary or slimy or whatnot, but you know, there are certain cool things it can do that other animals can't, you know, like maybe it can go
It can swallow an egg.
Yeah.
That picture, we went to the zoo, full disclosure, we went to the zoo recently, so animals are on the mind. But there's this image of like anytime there's a video of just this snake like swallowing this egg, it makes me so like viscerally uncomfortable because I'm just like ache, like what if it gets stuck, what if you can't actually swallow it. It's crazy. Anyways,
yeah, snakes are pretty great. The animated film Zootopia, which came out last year, actually dealt a lot with racism.
Oh, and see, I never saw it.
I'll do the short version. Basically, there's a bunny who becomes a police officer. And there's a lot of prejudice against her because bunnies are never police officers.
Right. No one respects the bunny.
Right. And then also, there'll be some slight spoilers here. I think this is okay, but...
Yeah. And most everyone's probably seen it. I'm the exception.
Yeah, but there's some concern about predators targeting herbivores, and there ends up being this prejudice against predators like throughout Zootopia because they're worried because there's a few predator attacks and they're like, oh, predators must be dangerous,
all predators are terrible.
Yeah. But then the plot twist actually involves a true villain not being a predator but being one of the herbivores. But that's really great because I don't want to spell it out, but there's like pretty obvious parallels there.
Yeah, well, also like it's easy to make assumptions based on like, oh, this animal kills and eats other animals, so that like places a moral value on that animal as opposed to an animal that doesn't, which
right.
can get into like diet like perspectives if you want, like children's books consulting the issue of veganism.
Well, I think actually that would be, I would love to see more children's books that tackle food choices, not just like, you know, drink less soda and whatnot, but like
here's the where it came from, here's the impact, and here's how you can like save the planet by eating differently.
Right. Because, you know, I mean, we give the example of meat. Like, I mean, that's, it's an incredible amount of CO2 that gets produced from the processes by which we get our meat. Does that mean we have to cut out meat completely? Like, no. But if, like,
building like an understanding of the infrastructure and awareness. I just had a revelation that we're probably going to have like 40 children's books in our, like in the incubator by the end of this. We'll be like, oh yeah, and a children's book about this. It would be really great to have a children's book about this. I do want to brush on the third topic you mentioned, which is death. And I think that illustration in children's books have a huge impact in terms of processing that, and we can pull in the thread of animals too. Do you have any memory recollection from your research that relates to that?
I mean, I remember thinking that, and like for a lot of kids, animals are sort of the first things that are the first beings that kids see die.
Mm-hmm.
You know, whether that's like a beloved pet, or maybe they see a dead bird on the street, or even something as simple as like they squish a spider.
Mm-hmm.
But they're usually encountering animal or non-human animal deaths long before they encounter
someone dies. Yeah.
Yeah. So like, I think that's a very natural point in a children's book to start, as far as like, okay, like, you know, animals die because you've seen some of this.
Talk about it.
Yeah, and let's talk about it. Let's talk about how it doesn't, you know, there's definitely like death is important, and there's definitely a grieving process to be had, but there's much more to it. And it's, I mean, the short version, it's going to be okay. But yeah, it's not, you know, death is a very natural part of life. And I think it's easier to start thinking about that when it comes to non-human animals, because there's a slight emotional disattachment because they're not humans. So you're like, okay.
It depends on who you're speaking to. Most people would be like, no, fuck all the people. It's the animals I love.
Yeah, there was a long running joke with Steven Spielberg when it came to Jaws, that like all the people die and people are like, oh, whatever. And then, you know, the dog dies. And you're like, whoa.
I had that reaction too. I was like, no, run. That crossed the line.
Yeah, so it may be an exception when it comes to
dogs.
Yeah, or domesticated animals. But yeah. I feel like, generally speaking, you know, a kid is going to handle, like, the death of a bird much more than, say, you know, a human being. So, yeah.
Cool. Well, I feel like the value in all of these topics in children's book is it does create a dialogue, and I feel like not only for informational purposes, but especially in terms of grief and death, like conversational purposes, like that's how you recover and heal, is by talking about things. So, you know, having, I don't know specific titles because I didn't do solid research, but I do know that there are books, you know, Where Did Grandmother Go or something, where it does talk about like, okay, here's, you know, a way for us to talk about what's going on, and then the kid can know that the conversation is accepted and encouraged or whatever, and allowed. So
yeah, I mean, that's, I think that's the great, I mean, part of the great power of books, but also just art in general, that gives you a space to interact with different difficult subjects, think about them, reflect upon them. I mean, just give one little anecdote. I remember when I was, I think, 7, watching, there's these, little known fact, there's 2 spinoff Star Wars television films about about Ewoks, which is a little...
Oh, I actually know of these, which is weird. Continue.
Well, they're in our collection at home, if everyone watches. But in the first one, towards the end, like, this Ewok dies, and I was 7, and I cried. So I was like, this is so upsetting. And that was like I was fortunate enough not to have experienced any deaths among family or friends up to that point. So that was sort of like my first, don't want to say powerful death experience, but
yeah. And relevant. And I mean, let me like branch out, not always death, also loss. Like sometimes things happen or you have to move and all of a sudden all of your friends are gone. So just processing loss as a child, I think, is a valuable skill.
Yeah. And I think looking to books, to graphic novels, to films, and seeing people out there, even if they're just imaginary characters, but seeing people out there who are dealing with these same issues helps you feel that you're not alone in them.
And kids love books.
Yeah.
I feel like all kids at some point have like a wave of carrying around books. And what kid didn't bring like 10 books to bed and be like, okay, just 10 bedtime stories. Only 10 tonight. Like, okay. Just wrapping up with your paper, you talked about a book that references a typical farm. Do you remember? Chicken Soup by Jean Van Leeuwen.
I gotta reread my academic papers more often.
You better brush up on this stuff. Basically, you say it opens up on this typical scene, and a cow is whispering to a sheep, and it like builds anticipation over the next couple of pages, and then explains, it kind of deals with. Deals with the issue of animals becoming food.
Oh.
Yeah. And that maybe that's not exciting for the animals involved, which, you know, speaking of diet.
Yeah, which is actually like, I mean, it seems on one hand, it's like, oh, it's just a children's book. But that's actually like a very radical concept that like, hey, your food might not actually be super into being food.
Yeah, maybe if it had to choose, it probably would not be so.
Yeah, I think nine times out of 10, they would choose otherwise.
Yeah, and I actually grew up, like, not on a farm, but with some comparable experiences. I grew up slaughtering chickens once a year, and my dad had a cow that we would, you know, say goodbye to and then have meat for the next year. Like, and so it was like, for me, it was like, I don't remember it ever being a secret where this came from, because at some point I was like, oh, we kill them and then we eat them. That's where they came from. But I do know that for a lot of children, that's a complete disconnect. And they don't correlate meat to something that used to be alive.
Yeah, and it's, I don't know, it's kind of a weird, it's like a weird dirty secret in American culture.
It comes from the supermarket.
Yeah.
We won't talk about it beyond that.
Just like the stork brought you.
Yeah.
Something.
We won't talk about that either.
Just repress everything. It'll be great. Yeah, it is like a really weird thing that we don't, like, parents don't talk about to their kids unless, you know, they grow up in some kind of farm environment where you can't
avoid it. Where you're exposed to something of that nature. Most kids in the city will never be in have an experience where they're like, oh, we're slaughtering these creatures for our consumption. Like, they're...
Yeah, I don't really see the, I don't see the issue with it. Like why hide it? I understand. I mean,
I think it makes even adults uncomfortable. So
yeah, they don't want to be like, well, this thing died, so you could have chicken nuggets.
Yeah, and then PETA.
Yeah.
Yeah. Another book you referenced in your scholarly paper that you don't remember is.
This is so scholarly.
Karma Wilson's Never Ever Shout in a Zoo. Which kind of vilifies, again, predatory animals, talking about how if you shout in the zoo, you might scare a bear, a big bear that might get grouchy. Like,
yeah,
so,
sorry.
Sounds like you have strong feelings about that book. Please.
I do, because that's, you know, right before we were talking about, oh, children's books can help bring, like, radical concepts, or not necessarily radical, but things that might seem different from the dominant paradigm. But then obviously the reverse is true in that like books can just reinforce children's books can reinforce stereotypes.
Mm-hmm.
And on one hand, I know it's the obvious defense is like, oh, well, you know, yes, the bear was betrayed as, you know, villainous. Like, what's a big idea?
Yeah.
Like, well, you know, it is relevant because bears are a key part of an ecosystem. And sorry. Well,
and you're just as likely to be like kicked in the face by like a zebra or something than you are to be like, if you're in close proximity to any wild animal, you've got to respect that they're wild.
Yeah, I mean, the National Park Service has said statistically in Yellowstone National Park, the most dangerous animal is the bison, not a bear or a wolf.
People want to come take a picture.
Yeah, they die for the sake of a selfie, which sounds morbid, but honestly, there have been enough news articles about this.
It's not elaboration at this point. It's something that happens.
Yeah. But yeah, especially in this case, like portraying primarily carnivorous animals. I mean, bears.
Well, and you reference another book that does a similar thing with sharks, which is The Three Little Fish and the Big Bad Shark. A retake on Three Little Pigs, I'm assuming, in the ocean.
Yeah.
I don't see the author here, but you can look it up if you want to get that book.
Yeah, these books I think are all still available online. They're all fairly recent.
Pretty sure if you Google, you can find anything.
Yeah, including that Ewok movie.
You were talking.
Oh yeah, I mean, I think portraying like bears or sharks in stereotypical ways is really dangerous because a lot of species like those, I mean, sharks are a great example. Like, a lot of shark species are incredibly endangered.
And also critical for ecosystem sustainability.
Right, yeah. They play a key part in like the marine ecosystem, which at the end of the day is relevant to us because of the huge amount of fish we eat. But, you know, if you tell kids from day one that like sharks are monsters.
Bears are scary,
mm-hmm. Yeah. Then like they grow up and then there's, you know, proposed legislation about protecting sharks or bears or whatnot, then like why should you expect them to care if their entire lives they've been told that they're
scary,
monsters?
Dangerous, bad.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So it's, yeah, I mean, that's, children's books are can be incredibly
but they can also be, and I don't have specific examples because I didn't have enough time to throw this together, but I do feel like there is an innocence that can also be charming and refreshing that is found in children's books of you know, just like, oh, look, it's my pet alligator, or like, you know, just these surreal, possibly dreamlike situations where these monsters are all of a sudden not, you know, mm-hmm. And it's never something that has to be established. It's just like, oh, yeah, of course, my friend, the alligator that I took to school and he snapped at the kids, but they loved it and rode on his back, you know, or just like the mysterious tadpole comes to mind for me, which is the fictional like Loch Ness monster. But it's like he just finds this tadpole and it just keeps growing and growing and growing. But it's his friend, you know? So I feel like there is this like charming innocence in the sense of like, I never knew to be afraid of this thing as a child. So it's not scary.
Yeah. Yeah. No, I mean, children's books like that are great. We're just like, let's just show that there's nothing to be afraid of in the natural world. Everything. I mean, be cautious, but
and if you do want a good children's book, there is one you reference. I Love Bugs. Shows how wild animals, especially unlikable ones, can be treated well in a picture book. Just kind of conveys passion that the author has that the reader can feel, and then like come to understand something that's, you know, often thought of as a pest or like a nuisance.
Yeah, bugs are amazing. I love bugs, which is why I love the book.
Whoa.
But yeah, I mean, insects, geez, they play an incredibly important role in any ecosystem on this planet. So they're a lot more than just these little things that buzz around you or whatnot.
So we need children's books that give a shout out and support the little guys and the big scary guys. All the middle guys are well represented.
Right. They're pretty fine. You know, no one, I don't think I'm too concerned about the public image of, say, the rabbit.
Oh, but they're not always sweet. You can't just gotta respect the rabbit. I don't like rabbits, so that's something I never had to deal with wanting to eat or not wanting to eat. I just never liked it.
That makes it a lot easier.
That does make the choice easier. That's why I'm okay eating cows, because they're sweet and wonderful, but I also was like, man, you're a cow.
Oh, I always like cows.
They're so spacey.
Remember, I can speak cow.
Oh, this is true. One of the first things I learned about you. We won't give a demonstration here.
Oh, we can't do... Isn't that the great thing about radio?
Oh my God. Okay. Will you please demonstrate how to greet another cow?
How close should it be to the mic?
That's fine. Yeah. Chris did that on the subway.
Surprised you ever want to see me again.
Just kidding. Hey. After that, I do like pointing out, I feel like every child also grew up with one version or another of the ABCs of animals. Like, A is for this animal, B is for this animal.
C is always zebra, though.
Z is always zebra.
Except I once saw a zebra fish, but I was like, okay, this is not...
That's a scratch.
Yeah.
You're so original.
Yeah, someone was like, I really don't want zebra to be at the end.
What are the other options, though?
Pretty much a zebra fish.
Zebra or zebra fish?
Yeah, I don't know of any.
I know, that's why I was like, I'm racking my brain.
Sorry.
Nope, nothing's happening. One of my favorite blogs is called Brain Pickings. It's curated by Marie Popova. And I looked up, and she has a couple of really great children's books. And one of them I've read and one of them I haven't, but it includes a lot of illustrations. So this is just me talking about this since you haven't seen them, and then we can discuss.
Sure.
So the first book she talks about is Strong as a Bear. And she talks about how it's an illustrated celebration of animals and their emotional presence in language. And it's pretty, like, simple graphic pictures, so kind of more blocky, not too detailed. But it talks about, like, stubborn as a mule, free as a bird, shy as a deer, hungry as a wolf, loud as a rooster, slow as a snail, quick as a hare. Sloppy as a pig, clever as a fox, pillowy as a poodle, strong as a bear. And I thought about that just because it is bears, and you mentioned bears in your paper. So celebrating different character traits that animals have. Do you have any thoughts or responses to that? Reinforcing stereotypes.
Yeah. My first thought was just thinking about the, like you said, hungry as a wolf.
Uh-huh.
And I was thinking about how that phrase is in Russian as well.
Because there were wolves in Russia.
Right. But it's just, I don't know. It's interesting that like that.
And there's a song.
Yes, right.
Someone wrote
Duran
a song.
Duran. 80s classic. Come on.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's funny how those concepts, like, what's the best comparison of being hungry? Like, being hungry as a wolf is, like, across cultures. It's like...
Or, like, hungry hippos.
Yeah, hungry hippos.
Neither of them, like, eat substantially more than animals their same size.
Yeah, I mean, wolves, like... Yeah, I feel like there are other animals that you love.
We went on the tram at the zoo, and the driver's hilarious, and he has his shticks worked up pretty good, but we're passing the tiger, and he's like, tiger eats about this much pounds of meat, which is the equivalent of 300 hamburgers. Can you eat 300 hamburgers? My limit is about 30. Just like, hamburgers.
Like, there's a strong theme of hamburgers at the zoo.
There was.
They were pushing them.
They were pushing. You needed to go to the cafe and get a hamburger. But also, just like, why not hungry as a tiger? There's a lot of hamburgers.
Right. Yeah. I would be interested to know, like, how do
if
those...
there's cultural, maybe if it's just like a regional cultural thing of like historically these people had more encounters with wolves. Versus a culture where you're going to have more encounters with a lion or a jaguar, like that animal becomes like a phrase or saying would make sense to me.
Yeah. Yeah, it is. I do like the cross-cultural connectedness, though, of like, you know, both like people in Russia and then English-speaking people being like, yeah, wolves are hungry.
They're always hungry.
Голодный как волк.
a random side note, because you are a filmmaker. I recently watched the making of Frozen Planet, and there's an episode about wolves that's like really touching, life or death battle between a wolf and a bison. I've shown it to a few people just because it is like the brutality and rawness of nature at its finest. So if you have any interest, it's on Netflix, and I enjoyed it, but you might hate it. So so now finally to the one book that I have read. Wild Ideas, the create. Oh, don't go there. Okay. She has lots of hyperlinks in her articles, and I just clicked on one. So that's nice if you want to go to all these different hyperlinks, but not if you're just trying to scroll. Okay. Wild Ideas, Creative Problem-Solving Strategies of Different Animals. And this book is beautiful. It's mixed media, kind of more collage-y feeling.
Okay.
And just gives all these examples of adaptations. For example, one that could apply to people in cities is step outside. Look, if squirrels can learn to cross roads by watching people, what can you learn by watching squirrels? All around you, creatures seek solutions. Pigeons procrastinate. Bees calculate. Elephants innovate. Bears keep count. You turn to friends and family for support, and so do other animals. Ravens use gestures to offer ideas. Hyenas cooperate to help the hunt. When they're seeking direction, dung beetles look to the heavens to see to steer by the Milky Way. And I again cannot stress how much I love just looking at this book.
Sounds great.
It's beautiful, and I love that is it. Like, let's look to animals and be like, they're so innovative. Like, what could you learn from, you know, meditating of sorts on this particular animal and the way that it interacts with the world.
Yeah, so I've been thinking sort of a lot about that lately because I'm working on this series of videos for this group called the Non-Human Rights Project, who, in brief, their goal basically is to gain legal personhood for certain animals that are sufficiently intelligent and autonomous. And so one of those is chimps. And so one of the things that I thought was really interesting when I was learning about chimps is that they do actively think about and prepare for the future. Which, I mean, like, I thought was really interesting because it's something that not even a lot of humans do. it's okay. But yeah, I just thought that was cool that, you know, maybe not only that we can look to animals to help us do things we don't necessarily do otherwise, but also remember that animals are trying to, you know, so these chimps are constantly thinking about the future and like, that's not a bad idea. And sometimes it's common sense, but sometimes it's not so much.
Thanks.
I feel like I was going somewhere and then it stopped.
If it comes back, I do that all the time. If it comes back, you can come back to it. I was half listening because I was trying to hold two thoughts. So I was like, I'm not going to do this. I'm going to write them down real fast. And then they'll be there and then I can listen. And then you stop talking. So on to my thoughts. We talked about this the other day, but I'm reading this book called The Upside of Down, which talks about failure and how creating a society that's not comfortable failing is really problematic. And they did this study with kids where they divided them into two groups. And one of them, they were both given tasks, and one group was told afterward, oh, you're so smart, good job, essentially. And the other group was told, oh, you worked so hard on this task, nice work, like, good job. So one was praising, like, you being smart, and the other is praising you working hard. And you can probably guess that the people who are praised on working hard go on to do other tasks better. They'd performed better on subsequent tasks. The interesting thing that happened was that the people who were praised for being smart, the kids, became deviant and had a harder time with the tasks, but also resorted to like trickery or cheating to try and like mask, this is the author's like premise, to mask the fact that maybe they're not smart. So you like have this ego that you feel like you have to defend. And I feel like that's really, I mean, child rearing as a thing is still relatively new in the history of humans. But if we are being conscious with it, then we need to be aware of like the ways in which we praise kids. You know, the whole there was quite a few stream of articles talking about how you should like maybe not compliment a little girl on her dress. And like, oh, you're so cute. Like, your dress is so cute. Like, maybe that's reinforcing this gender stereotype of like girls are supposed to be cute and boys are supposed to be tough. Or,
yeah, I guess, I mean, that's sort of going back to what we were talking about before, children's books and like how things are
communicated. It's all connected.
Yeah, it's all connected. We have a plan here.
Yeah.
We're planning for the future with the chimps.
Or I'm just good at winging it like a bird. Swan. Not a crow.
Listen, that's the only one I can do. Yeah, and just that, you know, the way things are communicated can have vastly different results. And, you know, I think that's sort of what at least Americans as a whole have been going through a lot in the past few decades, that like everything, the way that you communicate everything is positioned within like certain ideologies. So for example, like you said, you know, like saying that a girl's cute, like that can seem harmless and it might be.
But 10 years later, she's like, no, I'm not cute anymore. I'm a failure.
Yeah. It's actually like word choice can be huge. And yeah.
And value focus, building values in kids. And understanding how to do that in a way where they get the values and not just like checking a box.
Yeah. I mean, like, with the girl in the dress, little girl in the dress, I'm like, I don't know what, like, maybe I want to.
Praise her effort. You must have worked really hard to find that dress.
Yeah.
Just kidding. He is. I've never like directly raised kids, so it's all peripheral experiences here, but there's definitely a spectrum of kids. And I remember when I was a teenager, I was babysitting these two kids, and they were just so interesting and polite and fun to be around. And I remember being like, oh, if my kids are like this, then like, cool. But you know, it's hard to say like what their parents did to facilitate that process, because they were like 5 and 2, so it's like they don't really have a lot of like ability to communicate why they're so cute and wonderful. And then I remember, maybe like outing my family here, but I remember like a couple years later babysitting my uncle's 4 kids, and I agreed to it because I'm like, oh, they're my cousins, I've seen them before,
sure,
this will be fine. And it was hellacious. It was so awful. They were all so mean. And I was like, I'm never having kids. This is insane. So, I mean, obviously that's like day-to-day circumstances too.
Sure.
But yeah, like it starts so young where you're building and reinforcing habits and tendencies and you don't even know. It's like so intimidating for the non-parents out here.
Yeah, it's extremely intimidating. And then, yeah, I mean, I feel like if and when I become a parent, I mean, even like with these children's books, like I'm gonna look at these books.
What
and
are you
like,
gonna expose your kids to?
Right, yeah, because it can
animal like exploitation.
Yeah, they're gonna get the right children's books where sharks are friends and bears are cool, and they'll love bugs. but yeah, like these are like those are the kind of things that I'm gonna want to think about. It's like what are they being exposed to? What kind of cultural codes? What kind of ideologies? You know, are they being introduced to ideas
through subversive ways?
Yeah,
not subversive, just like, but very subconscious.
Yeah, because yeah, I mean, you might, you know, I think obviously the direct parenting is gonna have the most obvious effect on the kids, but definitely the cultural objects they're exposed to will affect them in different ways, some of which might be hard to predict.
The other thought I had as a result or after reading the blurb on Wild Ideas, was they talk about dung beetles navigating by the Milky Way.
That's awesome.
But I just listened to this episode of The Naked Scientists where they talk about how almost 80% of North America can't even see the Milky Way anymore. It's just crazy. Since she was up in the UK or in Canada, I don't know, different places, just like researching like light pollution, is it preventing us from being able to see the sky as clearly? And just the wonder of actually being able to see what all is out there. And so that's my non objective oriented ramble on Milky Way vision.
Oh, but totally valid. I mean, it's, I remember, so, I mean, for context, I grew up in the New York City area, which obviously has a fair amount of light pollution, not so much Milky Way.
Some.
Yeah, a little bit. You know, I went to college in Vermont, so it was definitely better there. There's some gorgeous skies there. But I remember when I went, after college, I went to work one summer in Colorado in this really small rural town, and for a whitewater rafting company. And man,
could see everything.
Yeah, those skies at night, geez, they were jaw dropping.
Yeah, and that's a similar experience. Like, you know, even if you grew up in a smaller town, there, you're still light. There's still, and then you get out and away from that. For me, that happened camping in Wyoming. I was just like riveted and hypnotized by like the mass of things that I had never even considered were there. I mean, you see pictures of space and you're like, oh, space, but you're like, you can actually see a similar thing if you're in the right spot with, you know.
Yeah, it's pretty incredible. I will say, for those of you who don't know, if you want to see something particularly cool in space, November 14th is supposed to be the super moon. That's what the media is calling it. It's basically like the moon will be much larger than it has been for a long time. I don't remember the exact reasons. You can, New York Times, I'm sure, can tell you, or someone else, but it should be really incredible. The moon's going to be huge in the sky. So November 14th that night.
Is that a Monday? Do we look?
I'm pretty sure that's a Monday. But yeah, if you go onto your local news source, I'm sure you can find information about it. But I think it'll be incredible. Did you catch
It is a Monday.
Okay, yeah, it is. So Monday, November 14th, super moon.
Done. Be there, be a square.
Speaking of cool moons, did you catch the blood moon?
I did. Not in its full regality, but okay. I saw part of it. Indeed. So the takeaway from today is be conscious of what children's books you're buying for your children and for your friends' children. Make sure you're buying books that are animal-friendly and people-friendly and teach adult values, mature values, perhaps.
Yeah.
But in
childish ways.
In ways accessible to a child. Also, take your child stargazing while you still can.
Oh, jeez.
And yeah, so we usually end our shows with a series of rapid-fire questions. You don't have a list of them, so I'll let you go first and pick one from your memory, or just to come up with a random question while I finish talking about how you're going to come up with a random question.
Okay, well, I mean, since we talked about these, how about a favorite children's book?
Favorite children's book. There's this version of The Little Mermaid that was the original version where she basically commits suicide. But the visuals were always my favorite. And so I would have my mom read it to me again and again. And there was also a book called Jenny's Bear that this little girl had such a love for bears and thousands of stuffed animal bears. And then one day a real bear comes to her tea house and she's like, oh, come back. And he's like, I will come back in summer. And then he comes back with all of his bear friends, and everyone's happy hanging out. Aww. So bears were never vilified for me.
That's good.
I'm like, bears are friends.
Bears are pretty great.
Come here, little bear.
We're still your friends.
Yeah. How about you? Favorite children's book?
I'm not sure I have a favorite, but one that stuck out to me when I was thinking about this was, have you ever heard The Stinky Cheese Man?
I have heard of The Stinky Cheese Man.
Yeah, that was, I read that, I want to say maybe in second grade, and it's really cheeky and irreverent.
quite.
Yeah, I mean, I'm sure if you haven't read it, you can tell just by the title.
Cheese man.
Yeah, the Stinky Cheese Man.
What does that mean?
Yeah, it's literally just like a guy who's a stinky cheese and he runs around and causes mischief. And it's just great. I don't know what cultural values it gives me about cheese.
Yeah, what messages did you get? How have you been changed because you read that book? I do love, I mean, there is a sense of wonder that I think is why adults consume children's books so actively. I mean, most people I talk to have a love, like, and actively consume children's books as much as, like, other books that they consume. You know, not just children's books, but they love reading because there's just this thing about it that's just, like, curious and wonderful. And if you haven't read a good children's book in a while, maybe you should check out your local library and just be inspired. And I don't know, you know, sometimes being childish isn't a bad thing.
It's true. Plus, if you think about a children's book is a pretty quick read. So, yeah. You know, if you hate it,
you're like, I don't have time to read. Great. This is really bite-sized.
It's mostly pictures.
Mostly pictures. Sometimes beautiful. Wild ideas. Plug. I'll stop telling you guys what to do, and I'll ask Chris, what's the last book you finished?
Ooh. Oh, geez. I should know this because I just finished it.
Test of your memory.
Yeah. See how memorable this last book was. I think because I'm on the spot, I'm blinking. But I can tell you right now, I'm nearly done with an anthology of stories by Anton Chekhov.
No, I'm trying to remember the last book you're reading.
Yeah. It's
it was from your work.
Yeah.
Library.
Yeah. It wasn't NPR.
It wasn't that. You read a book. We both know it. We just don't remember it.
Yeah. This is going to bug me.
maybe it'll come up while I'm talking about mine. Food and the City. And I liked it, guys, which is like, I'm a snob, maybe. I don't know. Usually I'm like, meh, whatever. This I really enjoyed reading. I was worried that I was going to have to go out and spend thousands of dollars on all of these new foods that I read about, but that wasn't the case. So if you're like, oh,
some
food in New York,
spent.
I'm gonna, but not at the places that I read about, and all the other places. but it's New York's professional chefs, restaurateurs, line cooks, street vendors, and purveyors talk about what they do and why they do it, and it was just a really nice, diverse collection of people in the industry and how they became who they are, or you know. Relationships they established, and I found it very charming. Your turn to ask a question.
All right, how about a book that you didn't read for a long time because you were too intimidated by it?
Pride and Prejudice.
Yeah?
I was afraid I wouldn't understand it.
That's fair.
I think I read it in college because by that time I was like, maybe I won't be completely lost.
Maybe I'll understand at least the first
Maybe
page.
I'll understand why everyone loves this. It's a fun read. I've enjoyed it. But.
Yeah. For me, I'll sort of answer two because they go together. Tolstoy's Anna Karenina and War and Peace.
Ooh. Yeah, you and those Russians were talking about this the other day.
Yeah, that was, as I kind of mentioned earlier, like, I had this interest in Russian language and culture, and so Tolstoy is obvious, of course, even if you're not interested in that, but yeah, I mean, they're
it's
both
classic.
They're both such massive works and held in such pedestals that I was just for a long time.
Do they hold up?
Yeah, I mean, so actually I read them back to back, which was a bold move.
Did you just break up with someone?
No, I had just entered a relationship. At the
You're
time.
Like, hold on, I'm gonna finish yeah. these books first.
I'll love you later, Tolstoy first.
Nice to meet you. Glad you're there. I'll be right back.
but yeah, they were both wonderful. Like, they held up to all the years of praise. To me, it was just a really great takeaway that, like, yeah, these books can be intimidating, but you know, maybe when you finally read them, they're worth it.
Let me ask you a question, because for me, I sometimes feel like an audiobook can be less intimidating because then I'm passively listening. In your opinion, would an audiobook work for those stories, or you have to be holding the book, sitting with it?
So I don't really like audiobooks, so I'm already...
So you don't have an opinion worth listening to. You're like, it's not a good idea.
Yeah, I just feel like it's a very different experience to listen to a book instead of read it, and a book as a medium was meant to be read instead of listened to. So I don't know. For me, I feel like some of the power of either of those books would be lost.
You purist.
Yes.
You've been writing a lot lately. Let's talk about writing tips. What do you do when you have to sit down and type something out?
I mean, are we talking for fun or just like something has
we
to
We haven't
with...
been writing for fun.
You've yeah, I haven't been writing for fun.
For business.
Yeah. I mean, I usually just kind of steal myself. I mean, I don't like to procrastinate. I just like...
We're opposites that way.
Yeah, that's why we work so well.
Yeah, carry on.
Eight. I just like to sit down, open my computer, and be like, all right, I'm just going to bang this out. And it doesn't have to be perfect, but it has to work. And just go paragraph by paragraph, sentence by sentence. It's labor, but it's so, you know, if you just put, it's basically stubbornness, just being like, I'm going to write this right now, even if I'm don't even.
Just like spit out as much as I can.
Yeah, even if I'm not in the mood to write, it's just like, let's get it done.
I like it. Could learn from your diligence. I've been writing a lot too, and for me, trying to work past some things that were former obstacles, my biggest obstacle, big surprise, is my phone. If I sit down to write and my phone is within arm's reach, it inevitably ends up in my hand and I'm not writing. I'm looking at my phone. Maybe being productive, but not writing. So that's been fun.
Yeah, I think it's definitely important for writing to keep distractions like that. They can be in the room, but I think the difference between having them in arm's reach and having it not in arm's reach is huge.
Yeah. So that's something that I have been encountering lately. And also a similar thing, I think, of just being stubborn. Like, no, I'm writing right now and I have to write until I'm done writing this much. For me, I'm using quantity as a gauge for daily quotas, if you will. So just gotta keep going. I'm not going to stop until I'm done. I'm just going to keep going. I don't know what happened. Like, I'm writing fiction, so I'm making... quote unquote making things up, but it's also this weird process of like, I don't necessarily know what's going to happen next, so I just keep writing. I'm like, oh, where did that come from? Oh, I don't like that. Well, just keep going. Like,
screw it,
you just gotta keep grinding forward, onward and upward. So that was my question. Do you have another question in mind?
I just had one, but it flew away. I'm waiting to see if it circles back.
It's happening a lot.
I know. Oh, I know. Here we go. If you could, rest of your life, you could only read one type. Do you choose fiction or nonfiction?
Oh, yeah. That's insane. That's not even a real question.
It is a real question. I asked it. Listen, if you don't want to be asked the tough questions, get off radio.
Hey. On the show here. I would veer towards fiction because fiction often contains nonfiction, but the reverse I don't think is true. Like, there can be elements of truth and history within fiction, and the reverse doesn't apply. There's not elements of fiction in nonfiction.
Interesting. I would say the opposite, and that not that there are elements of fiction, nonfiction, but I mean I would choose nonfiction just because I feel like...
I want the facts.
Yeah, well, I mean, I love learning things, but then also, like, you can still have rich characters and strong narratives.
But no science fiction. What would your life be like without Ray Bradbury?
I could read about sharks. Plus, I mean, if you read, like, some stories about... the act, like the space race and whatnot. I mean, that is like real incredible science fiction until it became science fact.
Mm-hmm. So that's nice. Well, let's do another easy answer, hopefully. What's what's next in your to read pile, do you know?
Oh, I think Arabian Nights, actually.
Ooh, classic.
Yeah, it should be interesting. What about you?
I'm checking right now. Animated Storytelling, Simple Steps for Creating Animation and Motion Graphics.
Ooh, sounds like we're going to make some films.
You wish.
I do wish.
Yeah, well, thanks for being here, dear Chris.
Thanks for having me.
And thanks for listening. And you've been listening to Radio Free Brooklyn. If you want to join the community and support public radio, radiofreebrooklyn.com. And you can also pledge at radiofreebrooklyn.com/pledge. Really long, a little goes a long way. All the things that people say to get you to put your money where your ear is. I don't know.
Give us your money.
I'll leave you with the word take it or leave it. Peripatetic. If I was a bird, I would fly high over the